So welcome to the 13th Prospectus podcast. Prospectus, as many of you will know, is a recruitment and resourcing organisation that spends its time only in the voluntary, charitable, third, beyond profit sector. And we are indeed a B Corp. We are really pleased today to have as our guest Steve Cook, who, as many of you will know, was editor of the Third Sector magazine and probably knows everything about the sector and everybody in it. He wrote a book recently with Tanya Mason called What Have Charities Ever Done For Us that they published and released in April. But before we get into the questions, Steve, would you maybe just like to introduce yourself to the listeners, please?
Yes, well, I'm a lifelong journalist, somewhat long in the tooth now, but I've worked in local papers, national papers, the BBC. I spent a long time working for The Guardian. I was a freelance a while. And most recently, for just over 10 years, I was editor of Third Sector magazine, as David said. And my co-author, Tanya Mason, she also worked at Third Sector before moving on to civil society media, which many listeners probably know about as well as the kind of rival media organisation in the charitable sector.
So let's kick off then, Steve. How have you found the adjustments that we've all had to make, I guess, to this new world order over the last 15 or 18 months or so?
Well, I think like most people, I've found it pretty terrifying and depressing at times. My wife and I, we've been very fortunate in that we've been able to live outside London and work from home. And we've been very conscious of the fact that so many people haven't had that kind of good fortune. People on the front line, people working in factories, driving buses, and above all, in the National Health Service. And the most I've been able to do to try and make things feel a bit better is to enroll as an NHS volunteer responder, which I did for the first year, mainly having periodic chats with people who were self-isolating.
That's good. And I guess I'm going to kick off really with the main question, which is related to the book, really, which is, with your extensive experience of the sector and all the key players and key organisations, why was it important for you and Tanya to write this book?
I think it was essentially an attempt to give the bigger picture about charities and voluntary organisations. There's a tendency in the media, especially, for charities to be perceived either as heroes or villains. You know, they're heroes when they take disabled children to the seaside for holidays, for example. They're terrible villains when, for example, things go awry for Oxfam in Haiti when they got into trouble with what was deemed to be inappropriate sexual behaviour. And we wanted to fill in the gaps in between those extremes. There are so many charities and they're so entwined in British life that I think a lot of people don't realise that they're there almost. And so, as I say, the bigger picture was our aim, and we're hoping for an audience beyond just the charitable sector. A general readership, we hope, will go for this and hear more about the huge range of charitable endeavour.
So that's interesting. So you're not interested, I guess, in just the usual echo chamber that we have around things in the sector where the same people talk to each other. You're very keen that this is read outside of the sector.
Yes, that is the overall aim. At the same time, I think people working in the sector are often very familiar with their own bit of it and don't see how their bit of it fits in with the other bits, always part of a kind of common culture. I also wanted to mention, actually, that the original idea for the book came from Joe Saxton, who runs the research consultancy NFP Synergy, because he, on a plane journey, I think, read a small volume by the head of the Arts Council called The Arts Dividend. And it was an attempt to show just what the arts contribute to society, not only culturally, but also financially in terms of, you know, GDP. And Jo's idea was, let's do that for charities as well and show what they do contribute in a much wider sense.
Great idea. He's always got a good idea, Jo, actually, I have to say, even if it created so much work for you and Tanya. But anyway, that must be a good thing. Good. And then I guess, again, looking back over the last 15 months, how has the sector itself performed, do you feel?
Well, I think it's performed brilliantly in the way that it always has in national crises, in recessions, in wartime, and now the modern equivalent of a war, I suppose, you know, the fight against the pandemic. The response has been absolutely magnificent. And when the pandemic struck, what we were immediately faced with, our publishers, Policy Press, were keen for us to bring the existing text up to date with examples of the charity sector's response to the pandemic, which was swift and wide-ranging. And just to give some examples of what we then included in our big rewrite at the beginning of the pandemic was how domestic abuse charities had drawn attention to what was going on domestically in some situations where people under terrible pressure at home, being locked up and self-isolated and so on, the domestic violence that was going on, there was a surge in that, and charities took the initiative in, first of all, exposing what was going on and offering help and advice and services in response. So that was a prime example. Another good example, absolutely brilliant, was Fair Share, the food poverty charity. One of the quickest, most effective responses. Before the pandemic, they were helping a million people every month, and by June 2020, that number had gone up to 3.2 million. They worked in cooperation with supermarkets and people who helped them warehouse and travel and transport goods and so on. And those are two salient examples, really, of the sector's response to the pandemic. And another one I'd just like to mention is a great little organisation called Hope for Tomorrow, which Tanya wrote about in the book. And they run mobile cancer treatment services. They've been doing it for, oh, I don't know, 10, 15 years. And of course, when the pandemic broke, that was just what the National Health Service needed, you know, to be able to treat cancer patients outside the hospitals, which were overwhelmed with coronavirus patients. And Simon Stevens, the head of the NHS, Hope for Tomorrow, suddenly got all these calls from the health service saying, can you let us have some of your vans for our area? You know, it wasn't quite as simple as that. And the galling thing was that Sir Simon Stevens, the head of the NHS, went to visit one of these vans and praise them to the skies and so on, but failed, unfortunately, to mention that they were a charity, were founded as a result of one woman's distress after the death of her husband.
Yeah, it's amazing. And a good point, actually, about the sector overall, that we do tend to, we imagine businesses know how to do everything brilliantly, but many of them just sat back, kind of, you know, like rabbits in the headlights, where charities literally overnight sometimes fundamentally change their operations in response to need, and which is quite extraordinary. And I'm pleased you mentioned Fair Share as well. I followed their work through the pandemic, and they were just extraordinary. And I noticed, big shout out to Lindsay Boswell, who just got a CBE. Very well deserved. For that.
I was going to mention that.
Oh, sorry.
At the same time, though, I mean, as I say, the response has been brilliant, but there's also been a kind of double whammy in the sense that the demand has been greater, but resources have shrunk. And giving to all kinds of charities, including medical research charities, for example, has slumped quite badly. And I noticed that NFP Synergy in its regular surveys found in March this year that donations to charity were at an unprecedented low.
Oh, wow.
For example, in January 2020, 71% of people between 45 and 54, who were the sort of the giving generation, as it were, gave contributions to charity. Mm-hmm. March this year, that figure of 71% had fallen to 41%. And that's a measure, I think, of the difficulty that that charities are going to have to deal with. They're adapting, they're changing shape. Some may actually be folding, maybe amalgamating, and so on. And I was just going to mention that, I mean, there's the double whammy that I've just talked about, but also there's a third whammy for some charities, because rather belatedly, in a sense, the whole question of diversity, equity, inclusion has hit the charity sector quite hard. Not necessarily, you know, across the board, but some big important organisations have been hit by controversy about this. An organisation was formed called Charity So White, to campaign really about the what you might call the structural racism in the sector. National Council for Voluntary Organisations actually went so far as to describe itself as being structurally racist. It accepted a case against it. And quite a lot of this has been happening. And of course, although it was underway to some extent before the pandemic, there was the death of George Floyd in America, and the whole Black Lives Matter movement intensified the whole question for charities. And I think there's a lot of difficulty going on in the sector about that at the moment.
Yes, you're right, really. So when the need escalated, as it did, there are all these additional pressures on charities. And it really is amazing to think how well they still do, despite all of that, actually. But it's worthwhile acknowledging, actually, that's for sure. Okay, so thank you for that. So a lot's happened, and I guess caused you to add a few other sections, a few rewrites to your book. Moving on, though, we know, and I think you kind of mentioned it briefly, there's nearly 170,000 registered charities in the UK. And all of them, all the ones I've ever come across, are certainly established to make the world a better place. Yet, if you were to look at the national media as your guide, you would imagine that there are largely some really, really, really bad guys doing some appalling things. And I guess, and we have to just presume that there are some good ones. I just wonder, do you have a view, having written your book, as why there is a gap between what, let's call it, purpose and perception? Or indeed, maybe there isn't, maybe I've got that wrong. But why is there a gap between purpose and perception?
I think because sometimes, unfortunately, the declared purpose is a sham and the charity is up to no good. And I think examples of this are very few and far between, but they do happen. There are some very, very bad guys out there. Now and again, they get caught. I think one of the best known examples was about 10 years ago. This outfit was set up called the Cup Trust.
Oh, yeah.
Which is a massive scam designed to elicit large amounts of gift aid by moving money around between contributors and so on. It was very, very complex, very, very ingenious. Fortunately, it didn't work. They got stymied at the last minute. But there are people up to this kind of thing all the time in the charity world. You just have to look at the Charity Commission website and look at some of the latest cases that they've investigated, and you'll find trustees walking off with the money, misappropriating funds, treating it as their own business, and so on. Giving an quick example from our book, for example, in 2018, the former chief executive of Birmingham Dogs Home was jailed for 5 years after defrauding the charity of around £900,000. 5 years earlier, five people in jail in Southampton after they used fake identity documents and collecting tins with home-printed logos to collect money in pubs. Mm-hmm. Pocketed £26,000, while the cancer charity Marie Curie received £263. They were pretending to collect. People are at it. Having said that, two things. It's like when police officers are caught in criminal activity, the publicity they receive, quite rightly, is disproportionate because it is perceived as so scandalous by the public when the law enforcers break the law, as it were. And I think the same is true of charities. Charities still benefit from a kind of saintly aura in the public mind. And when someone behaves in an unsaintly fashion, I think quite rightly it gets extra publicity. But these really, really bad guys are an infinitesimal minority, and the great, great majority of charities are set up to do good stuff. Most of them succeed in doing that.
Yes, I mean, and do you believe there's anything we could do better to improve that image of the sector? Because I take your point about the police, of course, and that is important, but I also kind of relate to businesses as well. When businesses do something wrong and make a mistake or something bad, what happens is that they may get fined or something like that, which of course means that consumers end up paying more. What happens when you have scandals that are sometimes blown up out of all proportion is that donations go down. It's not just a matter of putting prices up, but actually donations go down quite significantly. And that seems a bit of a shame, really, doesn't it?
Yes, that's right. The consequences for charities are disproportionate when they get bad publicity.
For the sector as a whole, I'd say, actually. But anyway.
Yeah, that's right.
Good. Okay. So, there is a gap between purpose and perception, I guess, is the kind of the answer to the question. And it sounds like little we can do about it, other than try and keep a cap on the bad guys, I guess. One of your themes in the book is how the state engages with the sector. Something that I've always been fascinated by. It'd be interesting to hear your view. And are they kind of respectful, good investors looking for social returns, or to use the language of business, do they simply go in and asset strip?
Are they respectful investors? No, not really, I don't think. Like most investors, they want control. And that's where the difficulty is, because charities, one of their essential qualities is their independence. And that interface with the state is the most difficult relationship, I think, that charities, especially large charities, have. And I think that it's interesting, you go back in history, I think that the tone of it all was set in 1601, Statute of Elizabeth, the first law which set out what charities should be up to. There's a Canadian academic called Blake Bromley, who wrote a piece about this. And he pointed out that the Statute of Elizabeth was really a codification of what the state wanted charities to do. And this ranged from obvious things like poor relief and education, but also the marriage of poor maids, and the upkeep of bridges and sea defences. Bromley argued that this was a remarkable and troubling example of the state seeking to co-opt the agenda and resources of the charitable sector. It is disturbing to realise that the enumerated objects are almost solely a reflection of Elizabeth I's political and economic policies and programmes. So there you have the state trying to co-opt the efforts and the resources of charity for its own political purposes. And in the words of Theresa May in the recent election, since then, nothing has changed. political parties they like, charities if they're the right kind of charity for them, and if they can co-opt charities to their political agenda and bask in the effect of glory, so much the better. And if they can use the resources to minimise the burden on the state and the taxpayer, all well and good. And so that's why government, I'm sure, is very pleased that, for example, ambulances, the hospices, and quintessentially the lifeboats are their charities, and they're founded substantially, if not completely, in the case of the RNLI, out of charitable donations. Yeah. And that that uneasy relationship between the state and the charities is always there, and it fluctuates and varies in its nature. And we're never going to get away from it, unfortunately. And at the moment, charities are being dragged into the culture wars in a rather unfortunate way.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's interesting, though, that when you think about this whole debate around government and government departments contracting with charities, when the government contracts with businesses, they seem to, I'll use the powerful word, they seem to trust them to get on and do it, and they agree on performance, and then they pay them when they've performed. Yet when they engage with charities, it almost feels like they don't trust them. Do you feel that's a fair point to make or not?
I think it is, yes. When the government contracts with businesses, the businesses call the tune, they dictate the agenda, they run rings around them, they're better at that kind of thing, at setting up the contracts and making sure that that it's advantageous to them. Mm-hmm. Charities are less good at that. They have less resources, and they're probably less cynical as well. But when things go wrong with the private sector, they can go wrong big time. I mean, Carillion, Capita,
G4S.
These big outsourcing companies who fail spectacularly and expensively from time to time.
Yeah.
But government just cheerfully carries on contracting with them. I mean, that's been happening a great deal during the coronavirus pandemic. The private sector has been used very generously by the government. And with charities, it's different. There is this tendency. I mean, there used to be a culture where the work charities were asked to do was done under grants, which meant that the purpose was specified, of course, but the way it was done was largely left to the charities. But increasingly, it's now done under very tight contracts, with very specific requirements, very onerous reporting, mean, and driving down costs. It's very, very hard for charities because in some cases they won't survive without public service contracts. And in other cases, they don't want to abandon their beneficiaries, even if the state is screwing them down. Right. And, most analyses that have been done show that charities tend to subsidize their public service contracts. Right. I mean, there was this big movement 10, 15 years ago to ensure that charities get what was called full cost recovery.
I remember it, absolutely.
It's faded away in current times. And I think that process of subsidy by charities or public services, paid for public services, continues.
Yeah. And I guess this might be, we can probably draw our own conclusions, but do you have any behavioural recommendations for the government if you're in a room with Boris Johnson and pals? What recommendation would you be making to them with regard with how they deal with this amazing sector?
I would say to them, back off and take a tutorial on the meaning of the word independence.
Yeah.
I think it's scandalous the way the government at the moment is trying to weigh in on charities that it doesn't like. The government is completely unashamed about trying to influence the charities that it funds in particular, but also the ones like the National Trust, which are entirely self-financing. And there was a story in the Guardian just recently, actually, about Oliver Dowden, the Secretary of State for Culture, Media and Sport, talking about this whole thing. And although the words don't come from him, they come from somebody who works with Dowden. The quote in the article was, "If you're giving that much taxpayers' money to the arts, then we should be making sure those organisations represent people. This is about representing the views of the people who elected us." Now, you think about it, that's not only terrifying, it's potentially unlawful. I mean, these organisations he's talking about are charities. And as the Charity Commission itself says in its guidance, charities must be independent, even if they are financed mainly or wholly by the state. So, you know, there are dangerous things going on for charities, and this is why the Museums Association recently, who've been lent on by Dowden's department, said that they're now living in a climate of fear, that they're going to have the government jumping down their throat if they say or do anything that contravenes the anti-woke ethos that Dowden and co. seem to be promulgating.
Terrifying, really. Quite terrifying. Okay, well, thank you for that. A very powerful answer, actually, I think. We're going to run out of time soon, so I just thought we'd finish maybe, it's possibly lighter, I'm not sure it will be, but I just, to finish, looking back over your, as you say, 10 years as editor of the Third Sector, was there any story that gave you a particular feeling of great joy or anything at all that we can end on a slightly more positive note?
Well, this is maybe a little bit flippant, but...
That's fine.
And I'm not quite sure whether joy or terror was the right emotion. But at one of our awards ceremonies at Third Sector, we were giving an award to the great Joanna Lumley.
Oh, yeah.
And she was there, she's quite a big personality, as you know. Yeah. And at one point, she and I were going to have our photograph taken. Yeah. And she came up to me and she put her arm through mine and she said to the camera, "Darling, this can be our engagement photograph." And it was a bit of a shocker. But on a more serious level, the thing that does give me a great kick, actually, and it happens every now and then, is the response of the British public to big disasters. And I suppose the most salient example of that came just after I started at Third Sector, the 2004 Asian tsunami.
Yes.
The response of the Disasters Emergency Committee was to set up an appeal, and the British public gave nearly £400 million in all. And I think it's wonderful that shows the intrinsic generosity of the British people working through the charity sector. Just mention two more things, perhaps, in the same theme. Again, not quite joy as much as satisfaction. And one relates to what we've already talked about, which is independence of charities. And in this instance, it's not so much the independence of charities from the government directly, but from the Charity Commission. I mean, in many ways, in all times, the Charity Commission is a big defender of the independence of charities. If you look at their guidance, there's a great deal about this. But there was a case in 2016 or 15, I think it was, where the Charity Commission, under the leadership of William Shawcross, instructed the Joseph Rowntree Charitable Trust never again to give to an organisation called CAGE. Mm-hmm. And CAGE was an organisation that had given some help and support to this guy, Mohammed Emwazi, one of the people in Syria who killed Western hostages. Mm-hmm. And it was horrible that they had inadvertently supported somebody as part of their work, who then went on to be a sort of homicidal killer. Mm-hmm. But the Charity Commission was quite rightly horrified by this, but they went too far and they said, "You must never again give money to this organisation." Mm-hmm. And there was a judicial review of that instruction in the High Court, and the Lord Chief Justice, no less, told the Charity Commission, in effect, that it couldn't do that, that it could not restrain the future discretion of charity trustees. And I think that was a great moment for charity independence. The Commission had, in effect, overreached itself and had to step back. Mm-hmm. And so I think that was a moment of great satisfaction. And you know, you could think that something similar could easily happen over the current activities of the government.
Great. Thank you for that. Before we formally wind this up, I mean, I'm sure there's lots of people that are keen to buy their summer reading. Where might they get hold of yours and Tanya's book?
Well, Policy Press are the publishers. They're part of the University of Bristol, and they have an excellent website where you can order copies of their productions, often at reduced prices. And one can go through the usual channels of, you know, that big online organizer, Amazon. And then there are any bookshop will get it for you.
Great. Good. Well, I'm sure it'd be great summer reading. I have a copy, might try to start it. Brilliantly written, as always, Stephen. Your very, very thoughtful answers to all of these questions are really appreciated. I think bringing somebody with your immense knowledge and experience together in one book will just be fascinating reading. And thank you very much indeed for doing this podcast. And I hope it encourages everyone to go out and buy your book and to read some of your interesting perspectives.
Well, thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk about it all.